Okay, so for those of you who answered this question, how much of your job involves data processing and analysis? Here's the results in case you're curious. It looks like between 40 and 80%. The other thing I kind of wanted to mention was, I got to disconnect here, one second. So it was pointed out to me maybe a week ago that in 2004, we had a conference that was titled Management and Analysis of Groundwater Data. And this conference is titled Management Analysis and Optimization of Groundwater Data. We will get into the optimization after the next break, which will be very interesting. But I also wanted to point out, I went back and I looked at those talks, and on our webpage we have pictures. And it was interesting that there's a picture of the audience here. Plug this in. Apparently we thought the future was 3D glasses like that to look at geologic models. 3D geologic models are still big and getting better, but I'm not really sure that the glasses are going to be the way. All right, so there's still some people trickling in. Why don't we have everyone that's on the panel come on up, and we'll get situated here. All right, so I think you should recognize everyone except Sharon Kronig. She's joining us from the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. Sharon, you want to wave? She currently oversees the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency's Ambient Groundwater Monitoring Network. And as part of that role, she has been very active in managing the network's water quality and EQUIS database. So I think she'll be a valuable resource for this panel for data that the MPCA houses. The rest, I think we all have had introductions for the rest. They spoke earlier today. Reminder that we're trying to use Pigeonhole as much as we can, so if you can log into that. Again, you can go to mgwa.org and click on the link at the top of the page, and we'll be monitoring that. We also will have some microphones floating around for those that aren't comfortable typing on their screens. Who's got microphones? So I kind of have a list here of the questions, but first question here, and I think this is maybe for Bob. When all the counties are completed, will the program be a cycle of refinement? I guess, Todd, if you can chime in on this also.
Okay, yeah, so that's a good question. So sometimes we've gotten the question is, didn't you already map that? Isn't that done? A lot of it is data-driven, and a lot of it's need-driven, too. So one of the last slides we had was atlases that are on their second go-around. So the early atlases were 1982, the first one, and then Washington County, Hennepin, Dakota, Olmsted. These are all atlases that are currently undergoing revision. Winona County is another example, too. So, yeah, it may be somewhat like that, data refinement, data-driven, and then need-driven, where people just need to have updates of their atlases.
You agree, Todd?
That's true that there'll be always opportunities to change things. We're doing things now that we couldn't have thought about during the early 90s because we have better technology, different methods. Plus, what I foresee happening is groundwater models look at certain problem areas that will refine the geology. Once you get new aquifer testing, or you might find barriers that aren't in the sand and gravel model, that would have to go back to the MGS to kind of complete the circle.
Okay, I think another next question is related to the Atlas series, and it's what kind of training is done to help the local government staff understand and use the atlases?
I think it's fine. The geological survey does some, when they finish the Part A, they do a local training, and Bob can maybe address that more. But then after the Part B is completed, we go back and hold a half-day workshop, usually asking someone from MGS to talk about the geology. We talk about the hydrogeology of the county, the primary author of the particular county. And then we have a two-hour training session where we have problems that they might run into citing a landfill, what happens if you've got problems with nitrate in your water, and ask them to use the maps and answer questions of land use and other things that are appropriate for the local units of government. And we've had good response from that.
Yeah, I don't have anything to add to that, except that, again, the Geologic Atlas User's Guide, I think, is an underused resource. How many people in this room have ever used it? Oh, good. That's good to see. No, that's good, because there is a lot of useful information in there and some specifics about how it can be applied to different types of problems. So.
All right, I think we'll go down the line on this next question, because I think each panelist can answer it differently. And the question is, if budget wasn't an issue, what is the one type of data you would want more of? Why don't we start with Justin?
Oh dear. Budget, huh? Well, the one type of data that we distinctly lack, as far as I'm concerned, is the type of data that the USGS is now starting to try and collect, and that is what's happening in the aquitards in the leaky systems. That to me is the real question. What's the leakage rate? How are these things stitched together? But that's very focused on my area of interest in Southeast. Plumbing's a little bit more complicated, say in the glacial drift, but it still applies.
Yeah, that's also a tougher question to answer, just because there's so many data needs out there. For our program, one thing that we lack is, you know, more information and deeper parts of the aquifers, just because those wells are more expensive to drill. And also more information on the age of that young groundwater in those wells too, so we can better interpret the chemistry data that we have. And also more continuous data, because right now we only have the funding to sample once a year, and we know in, you know, many of our wells that water is very young.
Okay. Ian?
From an ecological perspective, this is a really difficult question, because pie in the sky, I would love to have data that would allow us to understand the thresholds that we're trying to aim at. At what point do our systems start to change? That would be, and I'm sure that's tons of data from all different sources. So at what point are we changing the processes and functions of these systems? But it would be nice to have all of our rivers modeled in terms of the hydraulics in them. So all of these are, you know, that's the kind of data, if we were to just wave our magic wand and have everything we wanted. But a lot of this stuff is really, really complicated, complex even. And so I don't think we even understand, what is the statement, we don't even know what we don't know. So, anyway.
I think we'd like to have a better idea of the hydraulics of the system. We've mapped the geology and interpreted hydrogeology based on, we're now looking at aquifers based on the MGS sand maps. I want to get a better idea of what sands are interconnected, know more about what are truly aquifers, have a better idea of the hydrostratigraphy in the groundwater, I mean, in the bedrock system, so we can start defining aquifers in CWI and other places, as opposed to labeling geologic stratigraphy as aquifers. And we're moving in that direction, but we need more hydraulic data, and then complete the circle, go back to improve the geology based on that.
Well, I could take this in a few directions. I wish we had 50 years of data for our aquifers all around the state at a density that represents about five times what we've got. But I'd also like to have data on what makes us as human beings tick and why do we take our water resources for granted. And then there was one other one, now I'm forgetting what it is, but I agree with all of what you guys have already said.
So with the increase in funding that we've had over the last couple of years, so more than a couple of years now, with clean water funds and the like, DNR has put in a huge number of nested observation wells. This data is invaluable. So everything that we wonder about, just being able to get real-time data in different aquifers that are vertically stacked, is really been invaluable, and I'd like to see that continue, funding for that to continue. From a hydro perspective, the multiport well that we installed at Afton was really, really wonderful information that we couldn't have gotten any other way, but to be able to discreetly isolate portions of a borehole. And it sounds very focused, but actually it has some broad application too, and just understanding how these systems actually work. So I like that. An expensive mapping tool, Airborne ER, would show some promise for mapping areas where we don't have much well control. But again, that's very expensive.
Wow, I don't have a lot to add. I think I like what Bob said about something like the airborne electromagnetic or something like that, because we have a lot more data now than we did 20, 30 years ago, and like we've invested fairly well in that. But any area that you're working in, the complexity and heterogeneity of the system is pretty dense, and so. If you're at a given site, you can always say, well, I wish I had this or that for a site, but, statewide, it gets kind of absurd to even to even start to think about having the density of data that you really wish you had at any given area, and 20 years of data for that. So I think it's a really tough question to answer because, anywhere you go, you can probably think of 5 or 6 or 10 things you wish you had at a kind of level or density that would just be absurd to have statewide or in large areas. So anyway, I don't know if that helps, but I found that's kind of my cop-out answer.
Thanks. So another tough one, and this could apply to all of you, but I won't put you all on the spot, so if you feel obligated, chime in. The question is, have you noticed a shift from accepting professional opinion and judgment to a need to see extensive proof with data?
Yes.
Does that sound? Yes. I'll add a little bit onto that. And what would be some strategies to deal with that issue, in that you may not be able to collect the data and at some point you're relying on professional opinion?
Well, Evan and I were talking about this in the lunch line a little bit, so I'll expand on it. From my perspective, and I'm over at the Capitol just enough, hopefully not too much, the bigger the change that might be required, or the more difficult issue that you're dealing with, it seems the more data, more questions, and questions of the use of professional judgment become more intense. Understandable, of course, because as I said earlier, we're talking about Little Rock Creek, you're talking about agricultural irrigators whose livelihoods are, in their minds, hanging in the balance just about every day with what decisions the DNR might do, or do to them, is the way they feel it. And so as the emotion goes up, as the personal impact goes up, I think you see people more and more asking for more and more proof. And of course, we're living in a time where lots and lots of information and alternative points of view are available to us all on the what did Justin call it, the internet of things,
social coordination device.
Social coordination device. Thank you. So, I don't think there's any way we get away from it, but I also don't think that we're going to be able to replicate the kind of technical work we're doing at Little Rock Creek everywhere. Or are we going to be able to do that like USGS has been and others have been doing at White Bear Lake? But we're probably going to need to do it enough in a few places to convince ourselves that, generally speaking, we've got it conceptually right and that this is pretty reasonable and okay. We got to roll up our sleeves and make some of the changes that we might need to make. Now, I'm forecasting a little bit because we really don't even know yet. We don't know what kind of changes are going to be necessary. It's work that we're still trying to do. But we can anticipate that some will be needed.
I think this is one of those things that goes back to some of our original notions. Science is never absolute. It's why we spent so many decades arguing about whether or not cigarettes cause cancer, because you know the intelligence involved on both sides of that realizes there's gray, and yet it's sort of accepted now by society that in fact it does. Most of our burden of proof is a good thing. It makes us do better science. But there's a level at which, you know, we need to just say, what does the science say about this? What is the weight of evidence? And that's not one particular perspective looking at things, but from multiple perspectives, multiple views, what is the weight of evidence? And I think that's the best approach.
All right. This next question, I think, was touched on by Jason in the end of the last talk, but it keeps getting voted up, so I think maybe there's some desire for a little more explanation. And the question is, how is climate change considered for groundwater thresholds? And maybe Glenn or Ian can expand on what Jason already discussed.
Groundwater thresholds, the way I look at it, is really it's that connection between groundwater and surface water. And so the threshold becomes this thing that's been alluded to before. What is the point at which we have unsustainable or unhealthy conditions? How does climate change affect that? I think Jason did a very good job. I mean, we're talking about temperature change. We're talking about precip change. But also when the precip's occurring. In the Midwest, where most of the predictions are saying a lot more of our rainfall is going to come in very highly intense events. And we're also going to experience long periods of summer drought. So you set this up and we're changing the boundary conditions in our stream systems, which sets us up to really change to degrade the habitat in them through bank loss and erosion and all sorts of stuff like that. So the potential then is also with the temperature changes, which affects DO, availability. You can have wholesale community change just from the climate change that's occurring. So teasing that apart from the flow stuff that we're also inducing, those are difficult questions.
I guess the only thing I would add is, you know, for the specific case of managing the water appropriations and those impacts on surface waters, you know, in deep detail, we don't have it worked out, but I think, Jason, that, you know, the general approach is we're planning on some form of adaptive management where we're willing to reconsider, you know, what those thresholds are after a period of time. Now, exactly how you would determine that something has changed and not just part of a fluctuation that's temporal, you know, that's a big question. But maybe, you know, at some point it does make sense to reevaluate what the thresholds should be. Like if Ian is describing, you know, if there actually is a change in the system and you know the ecological form, if you will, of a water body, maybe what it needs hydrologically would then be different. But I guess that's the idea that we've kind of been struggling with. But we don't have a really strong view yet on how do you go about evaluating whether it's that kind of change has happened and that it's time to reevaluate what those thresholds are. So I guess that means that we don't have the answer that would actually be operational or functional to that yet. So.
Question for Justin. When can we expect it, and will the spatial database be available for use outside of a web interface?
For
the OCR test database.
OCR test database? That's completely out of my control. That's great.
whose control is it?
It would be actually the IT manager who's in charge of that group who's doing the programming is in the room, I think, or he was this morning. I talked to him. He was the one who fessed up to. fessed up to wanting to change the name of the data set, which is actually an improvement. I'm not sure what the schedule is, and Todd would probably be a better person to talk to about that. But the web interface is really basically the first step, as I understand it, to being able to get data in, and it would be internal to the DNR at that point, and I don't know when they would release it, but in terms of what is available now, just give me a call, and I would be happy to provide that spatial data set as a shapefile. So, Todd?
We have a database design table set up in Postgres, and we have a programmer's time to help us in the next couple months get an interface so we can start inputting data. We also have to do a lot of work. Local DNR staff, Lindsay Lottie is here, she's leading it, is have to review the data as we put it in. So we want to vet things as we load the data. So that's going to take a little while. But I'm hoping in the next year or so, depending on funding in the next cycle, we should be moving forward with getting a way of getting reports out. And we'll, as it's the near term, but I can't tell you exactly how long it's going to take other than that.
All right. Using a drone-mounted camera, this is maybe for Bob, sounds like. Using a drone-mounted camera seems like a great resource, and the 3D model you showed is great. Is it going to be a regular tool now, and is the software to create the 3D model expensive?
So the 3D modeling that we do in the subsurface is all done in ArcGIS, so the cost there isn't like a software cost involved in that. That's more of a time and training and writing scripts to do the things that you were seeing. As far as using a drone, I have no idea. That was the first time I've seen that kind of data. I think it does have great potential to do a lot of the things that we do. From a geologic perspective, it solved our problem in that setting. I should mention too that we had a photographer from the university who specializes in this type of thing, so he was able to do all those sort of technical details for us in terms of getting the thing to fly where you want it to fly and getting the data collected. So I'm always interested in ways to collect data like that, but in terms of building a three-dimensional model, the more generic you can make it, in this case running it all out of a GIS system, really makes it less of a black box, so I don't see any real problems with continuing to do that at whatever resolution we end up doing it.
Next question. Are there plans to develop a map that identifies recharge zones for individual aquifers throughout the state? Appears not.
I'll take a stab at that. So what's one of the big issues is where did this water come from, right? How long has it been in the ground and where did it come from? It's the big question in groundwater mapping and for deeper systems, it's always a big problem. I mean, just take southeastern Minnesota, for example. what's the recharge area for some of these deeper aquifers that have spring discharge. We don't know their exact boundaries. We do know that they're getting a lot of water vertically, and so I'm not sure we can accurately map yet at this point what the recharge area for one of those deeper aquifers would be. In terms of shallow aquifers, I think we can do that now, and those maps are currently available. But the deeper systems are much more difficult to really kind of trace back where that water actually started from.
I think this applies to many of you. Utilizing and understanding all of the available data can be challenging for researchers and communities. Are there efforts to link the various hydrogeologic data sets within and between the agencies? Kind of.
We've had some interagency teams working on ability to get data back and forth. One of the teams we've been working on is CWI, making sure that it becomes the primary well database for the state. Right now, DNR has observation wells, PCA has observation wells, Ag has observation wells, and that data, the location and driller's description, geologist description is not always correct in CWI. And so we've been working on how to get data governance. And basically the team that's up here, Justin and
sure.
Cherry and Bob and I, have been on this team with a couple other people. And so we've developed a protocol on data governance that says that the DNR wells will be, the information will come from the DNR observation well manager, and he will control the information CWI. And we hope to present that to the management team in a couple months, so we're moving forward with that. The other thing we've done is we've developed a protocol with a separate team looking at how to exchange data chemistry. And so we that's another important thing. It's harder because data chemistry, genre chemistry can be, the formats are different. Are you looking at how much information you store? How does the particular database store it? But we are making progress, and the examples, the good progress is Department of Ag and our own program at County Atlas are now sending our data to Equus, which is an enterprise data system that PCA purchased and is the primary lead on. So all the data are going into the same database and are therefore useful for everybody else.
There's also a national effort that pulls a lot of this data together as part of a national groundwater monitoring network, which is overseen by the USGS and the EPA. And back in 2010, the DNR and I worked on a pilot project to import, you know, some of our information into their groundwater data portal that's available. And as part of this portal, there's information on water chemistry from selected sites throughout the state, water level, and we're also working with the MGS and Department of Health to get web services available to link the information from CWI into that database as well.
Just a little bit of a historical perspective, what we're talking about is basically at a staff level, the coordination between various groups and agencies, which started out as kind of, as I understand, I'll probably not use the right words, but it was basically an outgrowth of the legacy fund at the high management level, where they said, well, why aren't we sharing this data? And so there's been kind of this evolution over a period of years at managers talking to one another to contractors came in to do a data model of everybody's systems, and then management took a look at that and said, oh, that's pretty expensive, and oh my goodness, that would be a big effort, and that kind of devolved into this data governance at the staff level, which I think is more organic and has a very much greater chance of succeeding. And from my point of view, is it's absolutely essential to have all the parties who actually use the data at the table, and that's what we were doing. So that's kind of the history of it in a nutshell, and that's not to take away from anything that Todd or anybody else has said.
You know, I want to underscore what Justin just said, but I would also say to the folks in this room, if you have ideas for how we could be better integrating the data that the executive branch agencies are responsible for to better meet your needs, that would be a great thing to have a small group of people formulate some ideas on, because Clean Water Fund has given us the ability financially to really talk and work more interagency than we historically were able to do. When you have very limited budgets, you focus very limited, your scope becomes, what is my responsibility? Okay, that's all I have. I can't even do that, but I'm gonna do it this way. So you don't invest in these kinds of things. Clean Water Fund gave us not only the ability financially to invest, but also a need and a reason to do it. And I think it's at the appropriate place, and that is at the staff level. Staff, what data do you need? Are you able to get it easy enough? No, I can't. Well, what do you need to do to get it? Okay, let's get that. Let's build Aquifer Test Database as an example, right? So those are the kind of things. And I think this group could help formulate on what are the other areas that we need to focus on integrating, because we are doing a great job with our primary data systems now, getting all the data in the same places. DNR manages the continuous data, the stream flow and observation well water level data. PCA is managing the chemistry data. And we've got the Aquifer Test Database, and then there's County Well Index at Health. So, and Ag's putting their stuff in all of our databases. They're freeloaders. I'm just kidding. Dan, where are you? they do pay.
Models, models, models. I love models. Are there plans to assess the accuracy of previous models against real studied scenarios? Oh, it moved on me. There's more to this question. I lost it. I think Ellen erased it on me. It was basically post-audit of models. Has there been any effort to do that? Maybe Glenn has an idea, or I don't
know. Well, I guess the short answer, from the DNR specific side is no, not really, because there just are very few models that were done in the past that were trying to do the kind of thing that we need them to do and that we could then reevaluate. So we don't really we don't have anywhere that we're working right now focusing on that where that would be at this point. Not to say, for example, in the Little Rock Creek area, there was modeling done for the TMDL project, and I don't want to discount what was done for that. And, but a model is a model, meaning it's not the real world, and they're kind of designed for a specific purpose. And it's kind of hard to explain, to the general public and legislators and things like that, people like that sometimes. But you can have a model, and it needs some major work to do to answer the questions that you want to answer in a certain area. So it's not exactly a post audit, it's kind of a redo. That's the best answer I get. And the other answer I would give is some of the things we're modeling it because you can't directly measure it. And so you can't post audit. I mean, you can post audit other things. You can check on the things that can be measured, but what we're really trying to get at sometimes are things that aren't directly measurable or even directly discernible from raw data. And so you can't check it exactly, the prediction that you're trying to make, because it's not something that's measurable. Like stream flow depletion, you're comparing a hypothetical scenario that never happened, that you're calling a potential amount of flow, to what was actually measured. And you can't measure that directly, because you're comparing something that never existed to what you measured. So that's my, I guess, my other caveat on that.
Strata and water do not end at state or international boundaries. So how do MGS, DNR, and other agencies interact with scientists from other states or countries to improve the data coverage and the interpretations?
Well, Actually, in terms of water, we do manage our own water here. We don't get it from anywhere else, groundwater or surface water. In terms of understanding the data, though, we do rely heavily on other groups. In particular, I want to mention the University of Wisconsin-Madison, the Madison and the Wisconsin Geological Survey. As we like to point out, we kind of ride along on their lead. We have good data, but they kind of lead the way in terms of how to interpret that. So we have relied heavily on those groups for helping to understand and guide our research. Pardon? Oh, of course. University of Guelph also, so our most recent partners out of Canada, have been helping with the projects, in particular the Multiport site that we talked about earlier, and Tony's going to talk about later this afternoon. So yeah, you're right. Thank you, Kelton.
We do have instances of aquifer tests being run in other states that are of interest to people at the Department of Health. So I can't say there's much cooperation. I just show up and say, can I have the data? And they usually find it as quickly as possible so that I will disappear. Yes, there are several instances, I think, out of my area, but more on the western boundary, where South Dakota, North Dakota, where there's stuff going on the other side of the state line that influences our public water supply wells.
A little bit different from that, but along the same lines, I belong to a North American organization of in-stream flow biologists. We have representatives from 41 states and 5 of the 8 provinces in Canada. And this organization's been as part of the steering committee that formulated it in 1998. And one of the things that came about after a short time of meeting and holding conferences like this one was that we're really talking about a lot of the same issues. There's differences in water law appropriate, first in time, first in right, versus riparian, versus a mix. But the issues that you're talking about, how do you find thresholds, how much water is enough for both the ecosystem or for the user, today's user, all of these things are very common across the different jurisdictions. So we're informing each other through this kind of collective as well.
Yep.
Go ahead. Evan, I'm going to ask can I ask the audience a question?
You know what? Yes, and I can poll them.
Perfect. Well, we don't even need that.
Oh, it's rhetorical.
So, I've been collecting some data myself, not rigorously, but it's it helps me. If you could all stand up. I can't because I got the microphone. All right. Now the question is, do you know how much water you use in your household on an annual basis? If you do, stay standing. Stay standing. Wait a minute.
I'm sitting.
You're about average. Every audience that I've asked that question of for the last 3 years, audiences this large and larger and some smaller, generally speaking, about this many people remain standing. And I always challenge everybody in those audiences, information is power. Go home and figure it out.
Before you sit down, all those people standing up, did you account for the food you eat or for the energy you is produced to heat your home? Or are you just talking about what you came in the meter? Because most of the water we use is reflected in that food and energy.
All right, good. It is time to wrap up, and I think that's a good stopping point. However, I would encourage the panelists, if you're available, there's a whole ton of questions left on this thing. You can respond via a comment, and this web page will be open through Friday if audience members have a burning question and want to see if it's been answered. But otherwise, thank you to all the panelists.